From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. The wolf is an alluring animal for many reasons. They're apex predators who parallel humans in many ways, including social structure and even eating habits. But historically, stories told about wolves haven't been kind. The big bad wolf has only become bigger and badder over time, and as a result of centuries of misrepresentation, wolves are now endangered or extinct in much of the territory where they once flourished as an apex predator. Yellowstone National Park faced a complete extinction of wolves due to hunters before they were eventually reintroduced in the 1920s, a decision which continues to be argued about today. Isle Royale is an island of the Great Lakes located in the northwest of Lake Superior, part of the U.S. state Michigan. The island has two key populations, wolves and moose, that exist in a single predator, single prey relationship. The wolf population, largely due to climate change, was diminished to the brink of extinction before the species was reintroduced in 2019. And because of the remote nature of the location, the reintroduction can provide a lot of insight into the wolf and their crucial role in the ecosystem. But John Vucetich suggests that it's not just the science that matters when we're talking about our long-standing views on wolves. It's also a matter of compassion and of understanding. John Vucetich is a professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Technological University's College of Forest Resources and Environmental Science. He is the author of Restoring the Balance, What Wolves Tell Us About Our Relationship with Nature, and he is also the author of the textbook, The Biology and Conservation of Animal Populations, which will be released in July and creates an accessible lens into environmental science that centers on conservation, not equations. John Vucetich, welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
John, you mentioned in your first book that you began studying wolves on the Isle Royale National Park when you were 18. What led you to that point?
Oh my gosh. I think it was accidents of history. It's probably best to say the wolves found me rather than the other way around. So I was at Michigan Technological University as an undergraduate, and there was a professor there. His name is Rolf Peterson, and he was leading the Wolf Moose Project at that time. And so I started off as a field assistant, as you mentioned, when I was 18 years old. And I just never left the project. I kind of graduated through the different academic ranks and then led the project for a very long time.
Tell me about the project.
So the project, first of all, takes place on a remote wilderness island in the northwest corner of Lake Superior, the largest freshwater lake in the world by surface area. And the island is distinctive also because it has a population of wolves and a population of moose that live on the island. The wolves are the only predator for the moose, and the moose is the primary food supply for the wolves. So they're engaged with each other in what scientists refer to as a single predator, single prey relationship. So their lives and deaths are intimately tied to each other. And so the project has been going on for more than six decades now, and for that entire duration, the central theme has been to understand how and why those two populations fluctuate in abundance. You know, sometimes there's more wolves, sometimes fewer. Same is true for the moose. And the questions are all about, you know, in what way are wolves impacting the moose population or the other way around. Some of this is just basic science that's of interest. And of course, these kinds of questions are also really important for people to understand what it means to live with wolves in other parts of the world.
So they are directly correlated in a sense, similar to what people see with like the elk and the wolf in Yellowstone. But even more fascinating is that they're so isolated.
Yeah, no, the isolation is useful in a couple of ways. Again, by comparison, to compare Isle Royale with many mainland sites, Isle Royale is relatively simplified. It's not simple, but it's simplified. Again, just the single predator and the single large prey. And on the mainland, just by a comparison that some of your listeners will know about, say Yellowstone has, three really important predators, grizzly bears, wolves, and mountain lions. And several prey species. The two most important would be elk and bison. Well, that's five species. That's five players to keep track of. That's more than twice as many things to keep track of as we have to do on Isle Royale. So that bit of simplicity is kind of useful for scientists. And then the other thing is that because it's an island, the wolves and the moose, you can't easily leave the island or can't easily come to the island. So if the population goes up and down in abundance, we know it's primarily because of births and deaths and not just because animals are leaving the place or arriving.
Tell me about the wolf population in Isle Royale before their reintroduction to the national park in 2019.
Right. And even just to go back just a tiny bit further, it's good to know like the long history of the island. It used to be covered in, you know, a mile of ice from glaciers during the Pleistocene. The island kind of first emerges from a predecessor lake of Isle Royale in the neighborhood of 10,000 years ago. For much of that history, no one knows who lived on the island. But from like historic times, times in which European settlers could kind of keep track of what was happening on the island, it seems that moose made their first appearance that anyone ever knows about in the year 1900, or about the year 1900. For about 50 years, there's moose on the island and no wolves. Then, again, just using rough numbers here, in about the year 1950, wolves show up. They would have crossed on an ice bridge. And from 1950 until, we'll just say 2018, 19, something like that, wolves and moose were related to one another in a way that was complicated. There were booms and busts and lots of growth of scientific knowledge about understanding how they interacted. And then as we entered the 21st century, we began to realize that there were troubles with the wolf population. And we always knew they were prone to inbreeding, but there were never real obvious signs of inbreeding depression until, like I said, in the neighborhood of about 2010 or so. And then what we started to realize what was going on is that for a long time, wolves would occasionally cross an ice bridge in the wintertime that would connect the mainland, primarily Canada, to the island. And in that way, an immigrant would come every now and again, but then climate warming occurs, ice bridges become less frequent, and then the inbreeding just kind of caught up with the wolf population. And about the year 2018 or so, 2017, there were just a couple of wolves on the island, the last two wolves of that previous population. They were destined to die without ever reproducing. And it's at about that time that the Park Service decided that they would restore wolf predation. And the only way to restore wolf predation under those circumstances was to bring more wolves to the island. And so in about the year 2019, that's what they did.
So you've said before that the title of your book, Restoring the Balance, refers to this decision by the National Park Service to restore wolves. And there were several that were captured in Ontario and surrounding areas and then relocated to the national park. And this is something that we saw in Yellowstone similar, where a thriving wolf population that existed in the 70s fell prey to humans who hunted them. Under the guise of preserving the safety of nearby towns and nearby livestock until their numbers were essentially non-existent. But it was different at Isle Royale because it was for different reasons. The wolf population had dwindled because of more natural causes, still somewhat caused by humans. Climate change is something that we definitely play our role in. Will you talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on the National Park Service's decision in this particular scenario?
The National Park Service has for more than 100 years operated under a philosophy for which an important part of it is to not intervene with nature, to kind of draw as bright a line as they can to separate humans from nature and then to kind of endorse and support natural things and to just make human impacts as little as possible. You know, when the National Park Service first started more than 100 years ago, that, you know, was probably a reasonably workable philosophy. And then as time unfolded, especially in the last, you know, 20 to 40 years, as human impacts become more pervasive, it's harder for the Park Service to kind of hang on to that philosophy. And you mentioned, you know, kind of there's a really interesting comparison and contrast between Isle Royale and Yellowstone on exactly this point. So when humans got rid of wolves in the Yellowstone region, they did it with rifles and poison and traps. And so the human impact was clear. What caused wolves to go extinct on Isle Royale? And there's a couple of ways to look at it. One is that it clearly was about humans. It's just a little less direct. It didn't involve pulling a trigger. It involved, well, driving our automobiles an awful lot, enough to make the climate warm. And so by one important view, that's no less human impact than what happened in Yellowstone. It's just you could say it was unintended, but unintended doesn't mean that it wasn't caused by humans. But in any case, the challenge for the Park Service, and it's a challenge that they still have to meet, is just generally speaking, how will the National Park Service respond to climate change? When climate change takes something away from a national park, what will their response be? They could decide to generally do nothing and say, that's just the way it is. It's sad and tragic, but that's the new world we live in. The other response is to say, no, as much as is feasible, we'll try to protect what's in national parks from climate change and proceed in that way. And, you know, the Park Service, I mean, it's a large institution. It's an institution with a long history, like many institutions. And so when they change slow. And also when they change, they have to be able to, I mean, it's one thing to recognize that a current philosophy is inadequate, this one of kind of humans and nature are separate, let's keep it that way. But what will you move to? And here's a problem, really, not for the National Park Service, but for all of humanity. We really haven't figured out what it means to conserve things anymore. Conserving will increasingly involve trade-offs where there's winners and losers. And the winners and losers will sometimes be well characterized as, you know, winners and losers being nature or humans or some combination of both. We haven't sorted that out yet.
You had been studying at Isle Royale for quite a few years by the time that this happened, correct?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, for decades.
What was your knee-jerk reaction when the decision to reintroduce wolves was made?
Well, when the decision was made that they would reintroduce wolves, I thought it was my knee-jerk reaction was that I thought they'd made the right choice. I think it, and I think the most important reason to do so at this point is that places where wolves and moose and the forest could all interact with one another, and where they could do so without really being overly impacted by humans, say in terms of logging, hunting of wolves, hunting of moose. You know, there used to be lots of places in the world where that was the case. And Isle Royale may well be one of the last, maybe the last place where those three trophic levels, the forest, the moose, and the wolves, can all interact without being directly exploited by humans. And it just seems like it's a good idea to have like just one of those places.
John, tell me about Trophic Cascade.
Trophic cascades are a simultaneously simple idea and complicated all at the same time. First of all, simple idea. So the basic thing is that large ungulates, so this would be white-tailed deer, moose, elk, it would be different in different places, but a large ungulate like that, they have a pretty big impact on the vegetation that they eat. In some cases, it's forest. In some cases, it's grassland, depending on the species we're talking about. And when there's lots of these large herbivores, they really shape what the place looks like. And if you have wolves or other large predators, they often contribute to reducing the abundance of ungulates. And if they reduce that abundance, then the vegetation flourishes more. And if there aren't large predators, or if the large predators are persecuted by humans, usually through hunting or something like that, and if those predators can't do their job, so to speak, then there'll be lots of ungulates, and that can have a large impact on the vegetation. That's the simple idea. The part that's a little bit more complicated is got to do with to what extent do they occur, and do they occur all the time? And this is where it is difficult to get an accurate perspective, even for scientists to articulate an accurate perspective. And so at the same time, there will be long periods of time in certain places where wolves, very naturally and not because of anything humans are doing, will just be a little less impactful. And there'll be a lot of herbivores, and there'll be a large impact on the vegetation. Other things that will occur, our scientists have made this argument in Yellowstone, is that for the very long period of time that wolves were present, it allowed beavers to be quite abundant. And in doing so, it changed the hydrology of the rivers in a way that wasn't easy to undo when wolves came back. And so some of those changes can't so easily be reversed. So there's all kinds of layers to the whole idea that make it interestingly complicated.
So in Yellowstone, like you mentioned, the elk numbers dropped according to the wolves' opportunistic hunting, meaning that they hunted for the weaker, more accessible elk, and in turn, the herds became healthier and less prone to starvation. The aspen stands that the elk enjoy so much got healthier too, especially near streams, and this meant that within just a few years, the beavers, like you mentioned, had more material to build their own habitats, and so their population boomed as well. Where there was previously, I believe, one single colony, there are now 9 of them currently in Yellowstone. And these aren't entirely conclusive results. Like you said, there are a ton of other factors. For example, the weather patterns in recent year and the effects that beavers have had on those rivers. But have you seen any similar effects in Isle Royale?
The short answer would be yes. And the longer answer comes from understanding how the Isle Royale is different kind of ecosystem in the first place. So it's Isle Royale's transition boreal forest. And so the three most important tree species would be spruce, balsam fir, and aspen. And the important thing to know is that balsam fir is really heavily impacted by moose. And spruce is not eaten by moose at all. So that when there's a lot of moose, it has a negative impact on the one species, balsam fir, and basically no impact on the other species. So that can alter the balance between those two species of trees. Otherwise, yeah, there have been long periods of time when moose have been really quite abundant on Isle Royale. These periods of time when wolves are just not having much of an effect. And when that's the case, the vegetation is really quite beat up. You don't have to even be much of an expert to just kind of walk around and say, oh my gosh, what happened here? And then there's other periods of time when moose are low in abundance, and they're low in abundance because wolves are having their effect. And then in those cases, the vegetation really is just flourishing. It's hard to walk through the forest off trail because the vegetation is so lush. And so, yeah, no, it makes a huge and obvious difference without a doubt.
And there are many arguments for preserving wolves and protecting them. Many revolve around them being an apex predator, a keystone species, having these ebbing and flowing effects on their ecosystems. Many discuss biodiversity. What would you say is the most important thing about the wolf as a species and about our role in protecting them?
Right. I think the most important thing to know is really, really not that much to do with the science, but actually more has to do with what you might call philosophy or ethics. And that's that, humans decided to try to get rid of wolves, to completely exterminate them from as many places as we possibly could. And we tried to do so, I would say, really for no good reason. And so it was a wrong thing to do. And we've made some improvements this way. We've changed our minds and decided, yeah, we can live with wolves. We've done this in the Northern Rockies and in the Upper Great Lakes. And again, I think it's righting a past wrong is the most important reason to do this. And I think this sort of understanding that wolves as a species and wolves as individual creatures, you know, they have what ethicists would call intrinsic value, which just means they deserve to be treated with some concern for their interests. You know, they're creatures that we share the planet with, and we should treat them, you know, kindly and accordingly. And wolves can be a challenging creature to live with, and we want to deal with those challenges, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be sharing the place with them. And so those, I think, are actually the more powerful reasons. The science reasons about wolves have impacts on the environment, and those impacts, those are the reasons to preserve them, is always going to be subject to two things. One, changes in scientific understanding, and the other is the politicization of the science. But they're very simple reasoning that creatures besides humans, have a place on the planet too. Man, I don't know any reason that can undo that. I think it's easy to make mistakes about what a non-human animal is capable of, but it's also easy to make mistakes about like denying what they're capable of. And so they have basic emotions, basic interests. And I think one of the challenges is that when we think of different kinds of animals is to just do our best to use a little combination of our imagination, a little combination of scientific knowledge that we have about these creatures, knowledge that you can even find on the internet, and just kind of learn about these creatures. And then just ask yourself, man, what is life like from their perspective? And boy, I don't think we're going to go wrong in our treatment of animals if we think about them about that way first.
And not only do they have these complex emotions, but they also have these very complex family-like bonds with their packs. The entire pack bands together to raise the pups that are deaf and blind when they're born, and they're always working together, and they have a very interesting social structure. So they're very mirrored in how they live their lives to humans. But historically, stories told about wolves in much of Western culture frame them as the ultimate villains. And there's just been centuries of misrepresentation. It seems to me that some of these similarities and this draw and tendency we have to represent wolves has also led to some pretty extreme political views on them. It seems that different sides of the political spectrum are at war using wolves as almost sort of pawns. Will you tell me a little bit about recent legislation regarding the wolf and what that means for the populations?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there is no doubt that wolves are politicized in a way that they're, again, they're importantly symbolic as much as anything else. The rundown on the politics and legal protections and that sort of thing, and we're only going to cover bits of it. So for some of your listeners who are very knowledgeable, they'll know I'm leaving out a few bits. But most wolves that live in the United States in the wild live in the Upper Great Lakes area, so Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. Those wolves are currently protected by the Endangered Species Act, which means they can't be hunted. And that decision was made as a result of the courts. So normally, it would be the federal government, the Fish and Wildlife Service, that would make a decision about whether a species should be protected or not by the Endangered Species Act. But if a certain group of citizens think that the federal government is not making right decisions on that account, they can sue. And you can sue in either direction. You can say, hey, they're being protected and I don't think they should. They're not protected, and I think they should be protected. And in the Upper Great Lakes for the last 20 years, there have been a volley of court cases going back and forth. And so in the Upper Great Lakes, wolves have gone on and off the endangered species list. And so, yeah, for the foreseeable future, they'll be protected in the Upper Great Lakes from hunting. Out west, different story. What's most important there is that in 2010, 2011, somewhere in there, this is a time when wolves were protected. And the three states in that area, we're talking Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, those three states really disliked the fact that wolves were protected because those three states wanted desperately to hunt wolves. And so Senator Tester, he added a rider to a budget bill that would kind of by fiat delist wolves quite aside from what the executive branch thought. And the executive branch would be the way in which that decision would normally be made. But Congress has the authority to do that. It's to totally politicize then, and it becomes a complete exception to the law. And really, just for political reasons, wolves were delisted through that mechanism in about 2010 or 11. There's two big questions about wolves. One is whether we want to live with them, and then the other is how to live with them. And we have really, in an important way, decided as a society, by no means not everyone agrees, but as a society, we've decided in some important ways we do want to live with wolves. And the wolves that live in these regions that I've been talking about are testimony to that. But we have not come to a sensible view on what it means to live with them and how to live with them.
John, you have a line in Restoring the Balance where you mentioned that what you call compassion-soaked reasoning could be this key for creating a balanced and fair coexistence with biodiversity.
You know, thinking of those ideas with wolves in particular, one of the things is that wolves are, for some people, challenging to live with. If you're a livestock owner in particular, occasionally, wolves will kill livestock that you own. From an industry-wide perspective, it's a trivial event. It's from an economic perspective, it's literally a rounding error. But if you're the livestock owner who is raising cattle or sheep and happens to be your sheep or cattle that get killed, I mean, that's a big deal. You work hard to raise those animals and you raise them for an American citizenry, many of whom like to eat that meat. And it just, if you're that person, it just feels like, wow. Just the rest of society is trying to make life hard for you by having these wolves here. And I think it's really important for people who love wolves to just really know that there are these instances where that's kind of burdensome. And of course, for people who dislike wolves, and when their response is to just want this kind of genocidal sort of attitude is just also wrong. And so, yeah, the compassion has to go around on all sides. And we were speaking about it for just this minute or two about wolves. But as I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's a number of cases in conservation where if we make easy, simple decisions in favor of humans, humans sometimes in great need to use resources that are natural resources that are available to them, nature's going to lose. And in some cases, if you make a decision for nature, it means humans are going to lose. That's the consequences of living on a planet with more than 8 billion people. And those decisions are really, really hard. And adjudicating who is going to pay which cost, who's going to make which sacrifices, requires an enormous amount of compassion-soaked reason, because reason has to be an important part of it, but we got to have compassion for all those involved, including those without a voice. And those without a voice are sometimes humans and sometimes non-humans.
That's John Vucetich. John is a professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Technological College, and he's the author of Restoring the Balance: What Wolves Tell Us About Our Relationship with Nature. John, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was a great time to chat.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us every Thursday morning at 10:30 a.m. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. I'm your producer, Reagan Edelman, and our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. Thank you for listening. Now go have big ideas.